Good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. This is the Double Phil Show. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
We have a very important interview coming up in the second half. We're going to be talking about the International Criminal Court with an authority, Tiffen Dixon, who is a author and scholar, but also a practitioner. She's argued in international tribunals. And we're going to be talking about the acquittal of President Laurent Gbagbo of Ivory Coast, because he's been in prison for 7 years, and the prosecution presented his case over a long period of time. And when they were done, the defense said, we don't think we have a case to answer. We don't think the prosecution has established a foundation of a case. And I'm paraphrasing. I'm not a lawyer. And the court agreed. So there is a little crisis of sorts, because now, after 7 years in prison, being acquitted, Laurent Gbagbo is still being held on the authority of some of the justices of that system, because they say the prosecutor wants to appeal the decision. Frankly, it's an outrage. I'm giving away my bias prior to talking to an authority, Tiffen Dixon, at 5:30. By the way, in future program, we're going to also be talking to other lawyers. David Jacobs, I know, who has practiced before these courts, has been following this. He, too, is registering shock, dismay, as they call it, over the conduct, not of Mr. Gbagbo, but of the court. So that's what we're going to be doing in the latter half of the show. But Phil, we have an announcement to make about an important speech being given over in Hamilton sometime soon.
Right. Michael Link, who was the UN Special Rapporteur, mm-hmm. which I think means reporter, on Palestine. Mm-hmm. Michael is a law professor here in Canada, and he was investigating Palestine on behalf of some function of the United Nations. Yes. And he's going to be speaking twice, on January 31st, and that is going to be in Hamilton, and I'm sorry, I don't have a good copy here, but he'll speak at 12:30 p.m. at McMaster University,
yes.
But they haven't a room yet. So just put it in your calendar and be ready to go to McMaster University for 12:30.
Check your local listings.
Check your local listings. That's us, guys. And again at 7 p.m. at the Mount Hope United Church in Hamilton Mountain. So he's going to speak twice on the 31st. And we'll announce that again next week. Because we want
the United Church. That's 26 Main, isn't it?
No, it's not at that one.
Oh, not at that one. That's my favorite address.
That's a great one. But he's not speaking there. He's going to be up on the mountain.
On the mountain.
Yeah. Hamilton has a mountain.
The place is it's United Church?
Yes. I'm having trouble reading it, but Mount Hope United Church on – we'll find it.
Hope United Church.
On Hamilton Mountain.
Let's not act like we're living in the 1950s. Everybody's already found the address, plus a picture and a photograph of the minister.
That's right. And it's called and the name of his talk, is called Annexation in the Air. And I guess there's a whiff of annexation going around right now.
So we'll also – I tell you what, Phil will double check. And as the show goes on in the latter part of the show, we'll announce it again, see if we have additional details. But – Michael Link, a very important figure. He's quite well known, actually, internationally, particularly on this issue of Palestine. And I think he's going to be talking about the possibility of annexation of Palestinian territories. Now, we have some important news, of course. We want to talk about some of these matters. The first one, I guess, let's mention that Tiki Mercury Clark, a good friend of ours and of the station and of the show, she has a public letter, we're going to call it. You can find it at Norman Richmond's Facebook page. She's addressing the matter of Gladys Knight singing at the Super Bowl. And I have to tell you, every year there is a lot of politics involved with this, every aspect of the Super Bowl. But on the issue of race, this is become sharper and sharper. And this year, a number of a prominent artists, led by black performers, have called on their fellow artists not to perform there because of the treatment, primarily, of Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback, who is, I would say, a high-value, upper-echelon talent in the National Football League, who is not permitted to earn a living playing the sport he loves and playing it very well because he has political opinions that bother the all-white, super-rich owners of those teams. We have a term in our 21st century, they call the million-dollar slaves, where you paid a lot of money to play, but you must not say or do things. And the owners, by the way, can. The owners can act out. They can do anything they like. They own senators. They own congressmen. They own cities. They own mayors. They can pretty much do what they want. I mean, unless it's flagrant, super flagrant. Then, by the way, when the discipline does come down, it's between them. It's a peer review matter. You know, we'd rather you hadn't, assaulted that.
Self-policing it.
Yeah, self-policing.
Yeah.
And by the way, little clubs can be mean to each other. That's true. But at any rate, Colin Kaepernick was very vocal on the issue of police brutality. There's been a poll taken. Incidentally, Colin Kaepernick has a Twitter account. It's a wonderful account. If you want to get, become well-versed in the history of the United States and involvement with slavery, racism, colonialism, etc., Colin Kaepernick actually runs a very good site. He's showing there the qualities that made him a great athlete. So when you watch the Super Bowl, you are watching a compromised sport where if you don't allow all the best people who are not criminals, he's not a criminal, to do their thing on the field, if some of them are not permitted to play, you're watching a watered down or compromised product, frankly. And I think that we should point out to the listeners of Tato Report that the biggest danger, I believe, that Mr. Kaepernick represented was the threat to the special relationship between the National Football League and the Pentagon, the American military, because they like to feed off each other. And a tremendous amount of camouflage gear and veterans and all kinds of things to induce young people to join the military unquestioningly and go abroad and kill people or themselves be killed is involved. It's a very ugly business. I mean, while we're watching a wonderful sport, I'm as addicted as anybody else. I watch. But there is that concern. And Colin Kaepernick, all he did was take a knee with the greatest respect. And by the way, he was advised to do that by a veteran, someone who had served and was a well-known spokesperson for one wing of the American war veterans. He said to him, Colin, I think what you should do, rather than sit down, which that seems kind of unexpressive, why not take a knee? And so Kaepernick agreed. And around the league, many players did. They began to punish them. That is a long story. Again, you should go to Kaepernick's Twitter account. You will see a discussion of how players, not just him, were treated. There are men not playing football now who quietly were gotten rid of. So we're talking about a famous one, Colin Kaepernick, but there are others who are not playing at all. So, free speech is involved, right to demonstrate, First Amendment rights, all got blown away. So we want to call attention to that. So Tiki Mercury Clark has commented about Gladys Knight agreeing to sing there when other black performers, and not just black performers, said they would not. So it's, I hope you go today. It's Norman Otis Richmond. I know you're two steps ahead of me and have already gotten there. So don't count on me to direct you. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. There's another important cultural matter, and this is the play, new play, and Phil, you know something about this. This is Ishmael Reed, who's been on this show, but he's, more importantly, he's one of the best-known American poets, writers, all-round curmudgeon, as they like to call him, and I'm sure he's proud to wear that jacket. He has objected mightily to Lin-Manuel Miranda. Is that the production of Hamilton, which is, I mean, taken over the world, and everybody's, you know, it's very much in demand show, but because it glamorizes or glorifies wrongly Alexander Hamilton, Ishmael Reed has written a play called The Haunting of Lin-Manuel Miranda. And this is not a light contest. New Yorker magazine has written a short essay about it, about the, Reed's work. And the New York Times has covered it, and has, as have others. About a week ago, Ishmael Reed went to New York City, where they did a public reading of his play at a theater called the New Yorican. And I, my understanding is it is largely culturally heavily influenced by Puerto Rican and Black American culture, Latino. It certainly fits the profile of Ishmael Reed's work, which is to challenge white Anglo-Saxon mythology about the history of this continent. So in the play, written by Ishmael Reed, Mr. Miranda, I can't resist this joke. Ishmael read him his Miranda rights. He's haunted by the figures, most importantly, or probably number one, of Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman was an escaped slave who actually lived in St. Catharines, Ontario, for a year or two. She was a true liberator of slaves. This is not a myth or just a little story. She was heroic. She was from the Maryland area, and she returned, she and her colleagues, and rescued people. And she did it with tremendous courage and skill and diligence, not matched by famous abolitionists. There are many people called abolitionists who now we celebrate. But not many of them were little women with just a stick and a bag who crept through the forest and spied on the slave plantations and then carefully extricated people without loss of life. I mean, she was able to get them out and to first free territory, the non-slave territory of the United States, but also when the crunch came, and they extended the laws saying that everybody, any escaped slave anywhere in the United States could be returned to their owners, they began to come to Canada in great numbers, and she was part of all that. So she wants to know, Mr. Miranda, why he would celebrate someone who was the son-in-law of the wealthiest man in America and who actually himself handled slave transactions. He didn't get his hands dirty. He didn't know any slaves personally, but he just simply bought and sold. Neither did he do anything. He didn't put his life on the line. He didn't risk anything. We're supposed to give him high marks because he said he thought slavery was a bad idea or that it should eventually go away. And the villain in the piece, or two villains in the play, Thomas Jefferson, who owned slaves, and Aaron Burr, who did not, by the way. Aaron Burr also was opposed to slavery. But I have to say about all of them, they were opposed, but they didn't do anything. There were parties formed in America to get rid of slavery. None of them belonged to those parties. They were all successful politicians, didn't dirty their hands. Other people who question Miranda in the play are the indentured servants, a couple of Irishmen, by the way, who are, they belong to people. you could not leave your job, Phil. You would know Irish extraction. If you did, you would be put in jail.
Because you were breaking a contract.
Yes, a contract. You right. signed it, and and you would do extra time for that.
You didn't have to sign the contract, but you didn't have to eat either.
Right. You had the right to starve. Well, within the master's court. You know who was an indentured servant was Benjamin Franklin, who was a little stronger in his views on slavery than these other guys. But anyway, just to clarify that, I mean, you know, it's very important that Ishmael Reed has challenged them. And he has called them out. I think they had four readings at the New Yorkan Theater in New York, and they were sold out. And I believe they hold about 2,000 seats. We're talking about a cultural struggle taking place. Now, so far, the multimillionaire promoters and supporters and creators of Hamilton are sniffing and looking out the window and pretending it doesn't exist, although they've been spying. They've been sending representatives to watch the readings conducted by Ishmael Reed. This, by the way, this is where you come in, the listener. Ishmael Reed is raising money to put it on a stage, but he, unfortunately, is not as well connected with the banks as was Alexander Hamilton, who worked for the banks, or our contemporary bankers who financed the Hamilton show. So he's of the People's Theater. By the way, People's Theater in our history, Canadian history, in U.S., People's Theater has produced a lot of exciting work over the years, where they started off in little spots, in little groups, but because they made a spark, eventually the world paid attention, like Waiting for Lefty by
Clifford Odets.
Clifford Odets.
Yes.
Thank you for remembering Clifford. When he died, Time magazine said, Odets, where is thy sting? Wasn't that nice?
That was.
Yeah, making fun of him.
Yeah.
Even though he had turned on his friends. This is an important story. Ishmael Reed, look it up, New Yorker and New York Times. You will find accounts. That's not the best place to start, but I'm just saying it's registered on the Richter scale with them that the portrayal of Hamilton is a dangerous thing. I have my own grudge against Mr. Hamilton because he's so misrepresented. In my view, I've been watching this for some time. Hamilton's greatest wish was that he become the commander and commanding general of the United States Army, and he achieved his wish. President Adams named him to head an army, and it was going to be the biggest army in the new republic. They were going to have 40,000 troops, and they were going to have 10,000 men on a horse. They named three generals because they thought they were going to go to war with Britain. France. Yes. He wanted to fight. Alexander Hamilton wanted to join the coalition of monarchies of Europe and Britain in a war with revolutionary France. And this was the great divide in early American history. Using really improper pressure and influence, Hamilton pushed the war idea. And Adams, they were both in the same party, but Adams was understood that you go to war, it could be, it's dangerous. But Hamilton, Washington was still alive when the campaign to fight France was being built. So Washington said he would serve, but he wanted Hamilton to be the guy in the field commander. The whole country was saved in that problem by President Adams negotiating a peace agreement with France, much to the chagrin, outrage, and bitterness and howling anger of the Anglophiles who wanted to fight France. And just take a good close look who he was. He represented the American right. They've been here historically from the beginning, and he definitely is of the right. So if you want a hero, make a hero out of this guy. That's who it is. But Ishmael Reed is on your case. Inspector Reed is I want to see that play. We hope that we'll be talking to Ishmael Reed sometime here in the near future. Because, well, remember, he's an artist. We're not talking about – he is an essay. He writes a great polemical essay.
Well, can we not find a student group to put it on here? There is all kinds of theatrical groups.
Pardon me?
We could find a student group here in Toronto to put this play on. I mean, there's all kinds of theatrical groups who are not – beholden to the wealthy backers of Hamilton. That was, you know, that's something doable in Toronto.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to call that a promise. Phil is going to find this theater group.
Okay,
even if he has to organize it. I think you're right. Yeah. This is a matter we want people to know about and follow closely. And give money to Ishmael Reed's program. Just go. You can find him on the internet. I mean. He's the editor and publisher of several.
Is that like crowdfunding? He's trying to crowdfund for a.
Yes, he's crowdfunding, as far as I know.
Well,
and they have already raised a substantial amount of money. And there are several black artists quite prominent who have taken an interest, as have Puerto Ricans. Miranda has an interesting kind of history politically. We won't go into that today. But another burning matter, this is a Taylor Report, let's remind you that. And it's CIUT, 89.5 FM, and we're going to be talking in probably about 7 or 8 minutes, I think, with Tiefen Dixon, the lawyer professor. But I wanted to say about the China news that people really ought to let's make sure we get this story straight, because you're not going to get it straight by reading the Globe Mail, Toronto Star, because it's now a partisan matter, and we're getting a lot of patriotic writing, which is never accurate, because patriotism requires certain tropes in what is called journalism. Go back and remember that Donald Trump said, all right, we'll have a trade war. And he said, why? Because he laughed. He said, they're easy to win. Maybe from his vantage point, he's a head of a colossus, so it might be maybe a win, maybe a lose. But Canada did not decide to have a trade war. That was not Canada's decision. Canada had been developing, cultivating business and trade with China, mutual respect, and that was all knocked into a cocked hat by the decision of Donald Trump to have a trade war. And people said, well, you know, we'll stand on the sidelines. There are no sidelines. When these things start, it's all elbows, thumbs, and illegal conduct. I believe that the charging of Ms. Wang of Huawei was a U.S. Forcing Canada to make a decision. Canada had been sitting on the sidelines or straddling, hoping not to lose all that investment, all that business, which was Canada's business, hoping not to lose that if a trade war was going to happen. So saying that Canada must arrest the daughter of the owner of Huawei was to say, we're kicking your tail into the fire. You are not going to get out. And the prime minister of the country, it's a fact, knew prior to the arrest. Why did he know? If he says we're a rule of law country and all that, why did anybody contact him? They didn't contact him to make a decision. It's not his business. He tells us that's the minister of justice makes these decisions. I think they were making his life a little easier because he can say, I didn't start this, but he played his part. And if you've been reading the Globe particularly, you could see this coming. We've had a steady drumbeat for at least, I'd say, 12 months of articles, negative articles about China, maybe two times, three times a week. So you could see it coming, that there was something afoot. We now learn that in Nova Scotia there was a meeting of the Five Eyes. By the way, you can't get whiter than the Five Eyes. It's Australia, New Zealand, England, and Canada, and the U.S. And they are Anglo, and they are They are indeed white. And they are a combined intelligence service. Some people would say espionage, spying, but intelligence. And they said you can't have Huawei. They told the prime minister that in July. I read a quote from him the other day where he said, we're not going to decide this by politics. We're going to go by what is our national security, which is to say the politics of your national security group. They have politics too. So they decided that this was going to happen. So we're being pushed into this, and nobody is resisting. All parties are on side with it, which is not a happy situation, in my opinion. Today's Globe is an example of where we're going. They have two articles, feature articles. One of them is talking about Mr. Kovrig, who's being held in China as something to do with their national security. And one of the articles says affirmatively that he is questioned up to 4 hours a day. The second article says he's questioned 6 hours a day. So, you know, the Globe doesn't even read its own paper. Because you start stretching the hours out, make up your mind. And by the way, have they affirmed that, or is that just we said so? We see, because of objectivity or reference to the other side's opinion doesn't disappears. There's also they've decided now to call him a former diplomat or a diplomat on leave. Well, he's something else, which they're not reminding us, which is that he's an employee. A senior employee of the International Crisis Group, which I think many people were surprised to learn that you could be listed as a diplomat, kept on the books as a diplomat, and then be moonlighting, I suppose, as International Crisis Group. And just to add, the name that makes the whole thing go up in smoke is Mr. Soros, who is the owner and director and chief and honcho at the International Crisis Group. He's not a neutral figure. He's a very political guy. He's proud of it, and that's his business. Mr. Ignatieff loves him. But the reputation of that group is, in many countries, quite negative. So you have a diplomat. You call him a diplomat now. You don't mention this other connection. I would think any country in the world would want to know, is that your ordinary practice, that somebody's a diplomat? And then he also has this other job? Saying all that, I believe in the presumption of innocence, so I assume he's innocent. But I don't think, as a practice, I wouldn't recommend that if you have a diplomatic corps, that they have side jobs. You know, that's going to come up in our discussion, by the way, with Tiffany Dixon, because I've been reading about the World Court, and they, some of the judges on the World Court, not the International Criminal Court, but some of the judges, the World Court, have been moonlighting. Taking cases where they're arbitrators and adding to their $230,000 untaxed income with additional income. Taylor Report, we call that corruption. We're going to go out on a limb. That's not right. So, again, this is the Taylor Report. We're going to take a break. I just realized we were going to play a little bit of Patti Smith. I think we will play Patti Smith singing Bob Dylan, and we'll come back with Tiffany Dixon.